Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The funny thing about the Fortune magazine list of America's 50 most powerful women in business is how much it changes year to year. Of the women featured as leaders over the past few years, the magazine reports that at least 20 have left their positions, not because they were fired, but because they wanted to. Power. The word, the idea of it, the pursuit of it, apparently doesn't mean to women what it means to men. Certainly not a lack of drive or talent, it's just that women say they don't want power the way many men crave it. In fact, for many of the women interviewed by Fortune magazine, power was a dirty word they didn't identify with. Ask them what they want, and they'll say they'd rather make a difference than be number one, and that challenging work is important, but so is having a life. Connection listeners, is that your experience? Would you say that power is less important to women? Or is this just a word game? Is power distasteful because it's a boy word? Would women say they have exactly the same drive for, say, influence or leadership? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in a moment, we'll meet two women from that list of the top 50. They're both executive vice presidents running one of the top biotech firms in America. First, though, a chance to talk with Patty Sellers. She is editor-at-large with Fortune magazine. She wrote the recent feature on women in business, and she's joining us from New York. Hi, Patty.
Hello, Dick.
Is this the first time that you've asked these powerful women how they feel about that word power, or is that something that goes with the annual list?
I've been asking this question since 1998 when we started the list, and it's one of the reasons that I wanted to do this story, Do They Really Want It, this
right.
year. Any time that I ask these powerful women, how do you define power? Almost consistently, they've responded that they define it as influence or making a difference in the world. I've also asked a lot of powerful men how they define power, and their definition tends to be very different.
How do the men define it?
Usually it has to do with rank and status. And I've always said that, you know, ever since I've been doing this these last five or six years, I've said that women tend to think about power horizontally. It's all about reaching out and having an effect, having an influence on lots of things that matter to them. Men, no offense, tend to think about power much more vertically. It's about climbing the ladder. It's what they're trained to do.
And so in your conclusion, Patty, this isn't just a game of semantics. It's not that power is a word that belongs to the male side of the corporate board.
Well, you know, it's so hard. It's so hard to determine whether women just don't like the word or they really don't aspire to the same goals as men do. You know, when I interviewed Hillary Clinton for this story, and she told me that she doesn't think about power with a straight face. And, you know, it's just like, oh, come on. And I said to her, are you one of those powerful women who is afraid of it? And she said, no, I'm not afraid of it. I just don't connect to it. I just don't think about it in relation to me. Now, of course she does. And I think here is a case where she doesn't like the word. But, you know, I also think that she does think about power in terms of influence.
All right. Let's check in with a couple of women who were asked this very question by Patty Sellers. And just a word before we meet them. They both work for a company called Genentech, which is one of the fastest growing, highest flying biotech firms around. They put something like a quarter of their revenue back into research and development. They've got new buildings under construction, 1,300 new employees in the past year, and a number of new drugs for psoriasis, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a colon cancer drug that's getting good reviews. The company is doing very well, so I should begin by saying congratulations to Myrtle Potter, who's chief operating officer, and Sue Desmond-Hellman, who's the biotech firm chief medical officer. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Myrtle and Sue are joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Tell me, both of you, if you would, what you make of the word power. Do we get lost in trying to figure out its definition, or is Patty on to something by saying, you know, women think about this in a different way?
Yes, this is Myrtle. I think the way Patty captured the sentiments of the women that she spoke to is really pretty accurate. I think that I know for myself, as I think about my business and I think about my career and I think about the contributions I want to make, it truly is in terms of influence and enabling the business or my family or my friends to accomplish certain goals. But I don't necessarily think about it in terms of my aspirations and my next steps, if you will.
And Myrtle, the influence that you're talking about isn't necessarily seeing your name in the society pages of the paper in San Francisco then?
No, I mean, my influence, the influence that's most important to me as it relates to raising children, for example, is helping them achieve their goals, helping them be the best that they can be, making sure their values and their schooling is appropriate. In terms of business, it really is all about helping patients. I've been in the pharmaceutical industry, biotech industry combined for close to 25 years, and there's certainly nothing more gratifying than knowing that what you're doing is making a difference in patients' lives. So that's what influence means to me. It means one more patient is doing better, one more patient is living longer.
Sue, what about you?
Well, I agree with Myrtle and Patty. I think it is a fundamentally different sense of power that many women have. And speaking for myself, I like Patty's definition of thinking horizontally. I think I know I want to make a difference. I want to have an influence on what happens. And particularly given our company's mission, which is meeting unmet medical needs, thinking about the influence that I or my group can have on human suffering is a really big deal. So that's a driving force for me, is influence and the ability to make things happen. Where I am in terms of the pecking order or what my position is really secondary to the ability to make a difference.
Now, Sue, you were one of seven kids in a family in Nevada. Is that right?
That's right. I grew up in Reno, Nevada.
And at the time when you were, say, 8, 9 years old, where you're saying, gee, I want to be executive vice president of a biotech company in charge of medical affairs, regulatory affairs, product development, pharmacological sciences, manufacturing, process science, and quality control?
Believe me, not. I actually have a very funny picture at the age of 8. I knew then that I wanted to be a physician. And the funny picture is me with one of my dad's white shirts on and one of my sisters being a nurse for me and my cousin being the receptionist for my clinic. So I was certain that medicine was a driving force. I will say that the thing that was interesting growing up is we would often have summer fun and things going on, and often my brothers and sisters would say, okay, Sue, what will we do today? So I knew I wanted to be a physician. I knew I liked leading, and I knew I liked directing things in certain ways to make things happen that I cared about. So I wouldn't say that power or executive vice president or any of that was in my line of sight, but I knew from a very early age, and my dad was a pharmacist, so I talked a lot to my dad and was strongly influenced by our family physician in Reno, Dr. Smirnoff, who's still alive today in his 90s. So I knew that medicine and patients and doing things for people who were suffering was a big, big deal for me. But how that would look, I had no idea then.
Now, Myrtle, you...
Sue, where did you come in the family? I'm curious.
This is Patty here. Go ahead, Sue.
I was number two.
Older brother, yeah. Or older sister?
Older sister, brother. Who is a nurse.
Older sister.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why are you asking, Patty?
Well, it's a question that I've asked a lot of these women, and they do tend to be oldest, or there are quite a few women who grew up with all brothers. Anne Mulcahy, the CEO of Xerox, did. Sally Krawcheck, the CEO of Smith Barney, did. And, you know, they grew up competing with boys.
And measuring achievement by male terms rather than female terms?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they were special in the family, and yet they were special, but they also sort of had to keep up with the boys. So I'm just always curious about that.
Myrtle Potter, you grew up in one of the poorest towns in New Mexico, Las Cruces. And as a kid, your dad said you could do anything. Now, my father said the same thing to me. In fact, probably parents say it to kids all over the country. Why did it stick with you? Why, when your father said you can do anything, did it somehow stick?
Well, actually, both parents really expressed those sentiments for all the kids in my family. There are six of us. I have four sisters and one brother. I'm the second oldest in my family, just like Sue. And I don't know why it stuck, except for they were pretty consistent in their messaging to us. It was very important to them for us to excel in school. It was very important for us to have a very good sense of ourselves and to really feel like with our abilities properly applied, we really could excel at most anything that we did. And that was just the messaging that we got on a very consistent basis.
Now, at some point, your dad remortgaged his home so he could pay the tuition to send you off to the University of Chicago. At that time, Myrtle, were you plotting a career as an executive vice president, as a chief operating officer at a firm like Genentech?
Well, at the time, I finished high school early because I was getting bored, and I asked my parents to let me graduate from high school early, and I wanted to start college. And my parents at the time thought that the local university would be a wonderful spot for me, and I happened to disagree. So I knew at the time I wanted to be an attorney. At least that's what my aspirations were then. But I also knew that I wanted to go to a great law school, and at the time the University of Chicago had the number one law school in the country. And I thought that if I went to University of Chicago as an undergraduate student, it would be easier for me to get into the law school. So I asked my father to help me to go to Chicago, and he thought, boy, that's just a lot of money. So I made an agreement with him, and my agreement was that at the age of, I guess I was probably around 16, 17, that if I started school at New Mexico State, if I showed him by taking junior and senior level courses and in heavy workload that I wasn't challenged, I asked him if I did all that, would he help me to go to the University of Chicago? And I did that. I fulfilled my end of the bargain. I did well in that first semester. And as a result, he agreed to help me go to the University of Chicago and as a result had to mortgage the house to send me.
You put a lot of pressure on yourself then.
I would say I do put pressure on myself, but for very specific reasons. I just think that anything that we do, anything you try to get involved with, you should do the best that you can. You should really make a difference in everything that you do. And so my personal standard for myself is whether it's with my family, my friends, my job, my goal is to make a difference and to really have affect an outcome.
Now, Connection listeners, in male terms, doing the best that you can is frequently getting all the way to the president's office. And a new article in Fortune magazine says that doing the best that you can, having the most influence that you can, may not be as directly equated with our current social notions of what power represents, certainly in the corporate world. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Give us a call and tell us whether or not you think women and men have different notions of what power actually is. And this may not be just in the corporate world. This may be in politics as well. We'll have a chance to test that with Nancy Pelosi when we come back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number's 1-800-423-8255. In a conversation this hour about women and power, a new article in Fortune magazine looking at the 50 most powerful women in business in America says that many of them actually wouldn't reach for that number one job given the choice, and it raises some very interesting questions about different interpretations of power. We have with us on the program today Myrtle Potter and Sue Desmond-Hellman. They are executive vice presidents in different capacities with Genentech, one of the top biotech companies in America. They are both on that list of the top 50. Patty Sellers also with us. She wrote the article, and we're joined now on the line by Nancy Pelosi, who is Democratic House leader and Congresswoman from California. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Tell me, you've had
the connection.
You've had a chance to listen in a little bit. Do you see this notion of power in government in the similar terms that perhaps women in American politics aren't as hungry for that top job?
Well, I think that women want to get a job done, and that's really the goal, to make the future better for our country and for our children and grandchildren. So it isn't about acquiring power per se. It's about what you can accomplish with it. But when we're talking about the top job, if we're talking about the top job in our field, which is the presidency of the United States, I certainly hope that women will be interested in that. In fact, I know some I think are.
We were talking about her just a little bit earlier in the program. I want to know, though, whether or not you see politics or government as lagging or leading the corporate world here when it comes to providing women the opportunity to have that influence.
I'm the leader in the House. This is a very major step that my colleagues would understand how important it is to have someone break in line after 200 years to become the first leader in the party in Congress and possibly with 12 votes to become the first woman Speaker of the House. We consider that a very reasonable prospect and goal, and it's a very big deal. The difference I see between what we do and what happens in corporate America is that much of what we do, you have to fight for. Power, whatever you want to call it, position is not something that is ever given away in the history of the world. You have to go in there, you have to fight for it, you have to win votes to do it. As an outsider, in the corporate world, mentoring and having someone try to spot your talent and bring you up the ranks, whether you're a man or a woman, is from an outsider looks like that's an important way for someone to get the top spot, to be pegged for it. That really doesn't happen in politics. It's something that you just go out there and fight for.
Now, Patty Sellers, you make the point in your article that many of the women you interviewed specifically don't want to go out and fight for that power. They want to be given that power on the strength of their achievements, right?
Yeah, it was really amazing to me how many women I talked to who said they didn't seek a promotion or they actually rejected promotions. Myrtle, you rejected a couple of promotions earlier in your career. And is Nancy Pelosi still on the line?
Yeah, you bet.
Yes, I am.
What you told me about the responsibility that you feel in Congress to advance women, I thought was terrific and really inspiring, and I think you have an opportunity to make a difference in government that really, you know, one woman can't really make in corporate America. I mean, as powerful as Carly Fiorina is, and, you know, I don't think she feels as strongly, I don't want to speak for her, but I don't think she feels as strongly as good as HP has been in promoting women, and they've been terrific. I don't think she feels sort of the fever, the passion to advance women as you do. And, you know, you told me that you put three women on key committees that had never had women on them before, and that's terrific. So I think there's huge opportunity in government.
I appreciate you saying that, Patty. These were minority women. They had not had minority women on some of these committees. And here, but I will say this, obviously those of us who have attained power, and it's new, this level of power in politics, in the Congress, it's never happened, it's historic, have a real responsibility to put women, give them platforms from which they can spring. You have to have a platform. You can't go from the bottom job to the top job because you decide you want to have it. And, of course, it's all based on achievement. Anyone who will advance will have a record of legislative achievement and political success to attract the kind of support to go forward. But it's all in our business, all about platforms, giving women a place to spring from, to advance from, and then have confidence in their talent, of course, to do that.
Congresswoman Pelosi, just one question before you go. When since you've taken the job as Democratic House Leader, have people said to you, you're doing this different from the people who had the job ahead of you?
Of course they do. Of course they do. And you're very astute to ask that question. Sometimes it will be in form of criticism, well, she's not doing it the way others have done it. And I think that's exactly the point. And some may not be comfortable with that because they're used to the environment in which they succeeded. And now we want other people to succeed, new people, women, minorities, et cetera. So I have to, shall we say, leapfrog over some of the traditional ways of doing things. And we had the frog be the symbol of our activities because we were going to be leapfrogging over all assumptions, practices, and pecking orders in order to make a qualitative advance for women, not only me, in the Congress.
Okay, I have one more question. I have three of the most powerful women on the country with me now on the program. What are they putting in the drinking water in San Francisco?
Well, the women, California has always been receptive to women. Two of our United States senators, our two California senators are from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
And in California in general, we have 33 Democrats in the Congress from California, 17 are women. And that doesn't even count the two senators, which would make it 15 out of the 35 Democrats in Congress. But that same drinking water led 80% of the city of San Francisco to vote against the recall. So there's something here. There's something to this.
Congresswoman, thanks for being
with us. Thank you, Dick. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with these powerful women. Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Nancy.
That's Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, Democratic House Leader. A reminder, Connection listeners, we're talking about women and power on our program this hour, taking as a sort of tip of the diving board a story that's written in Fortune magazine saying that women at the top don't want that power quite as much as we might expect they do. And I want to go back to my two executive vice presidents, Myrtle Potter and Sue Desmond-Hellman, and pick up the point that Congresswoman Pelosi mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that in order to succeed in the business that she's in, you really do have to fight for everything that you want. You can't be nominated just because you're doing a good job. You can't be elected just because you're doing a good job. But I get the impression from reading about the two of you, and our research is very, very good here, that you both have succeeded in large part because you're just good at what you do, that you don't go hunting for jobs that are one step up on the ladder. Is that fair?
This is Myrtle. I think that's very fair. I think if you got to know both Sue and I, you know that what motivates us is doing a good job in the job that we're in. And Patty mentioned earlier that just a little bit about my career history. One of the things I'm very proud of is that I've never asked for a promotion, and I have a specific reason for that, and that is that I always felt that if I did a good job in the job I was in, if I made a difference, took the job one step beyond where it was when I took it over, then my accomplishments and my contributions would speak for themselves. I think it's fair to say that we probably don't sit there climb and pine for the next job.
But Sue, surely to goodness there are people who, women or men, might be great at a job. And if they say, oh, well, if I don't get noticed or someone doesn't see the good job I'm doing, that's just the way life works.
I think that's a good point. And the one thing I wouldn't want your listeners to come away thinking is that there's anything passive about Myrtle or I. As Myrtle mm-hmm. mentioned, we're incredibly driven and aggressive about getting done what needs to be done to get the products that we're
right.
developing to patients. So every day we come to work and we're pushing and we're driven and we're focused, but we're focused on what we're trying to do at Genentech, which is bring new products to patients who we think will benefit from them. And so there's nothing passive about that. There's nothing sit back in your chair and hope that all goes well. It's the focus. The focus is on what we want to accomplish as a company and as a business. And we're really driven by that. The sense that if we do that well, all will work out in the end, I think is something that probably is more common in females than males, that mm-hmm. if I do a good job, someone will notice and I'll be fine. But I think part of that is because the goal is to get a product approved, to bring a product to market for many, many patients who could benefit. The goal isn't my next job or where I'll be or what my title will be.
More like being measured by your achievements rather than what your salary is or how big your office is or whether or not you're listed higher on the company's list of executives.
Oh, my. I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's the achievements, and we measure our achievements because of our business in products. So you'll hear Myrtle and I often speak about what you talked about as we started the program, the number of potential products we'll launch this year for right. asthma, psoriasis, and cancer. That's what we're driven by.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Kate's joining us now. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. The point I want to make is a bit different from what your panelists have been saying, because I think that women are very interested in power and are very interested in being recognized for that power with positions. I recently left a position with the federal government at a fairly high level. And with the federal government, at least my entity, title and position mattered a lot. And I had a fairly high position in the Boston office. And you were measured both in the community and in the hierarchy on the federal level by what your power and what your position was.
Do you suppose, Kate, that's because it is a bureaucracy and the structure is therefore different from a corporation?
No, I really don't. And frankly, I'm a bit skeptical that at any corporation, if the women on the panel were not recognized and given the important titles they were given,
right.
that they would be so sanguine about the recognition of their talents. I mean, and one of the points I also want to make is now that I am home with the kids, I miss that power. I miss it very much. I used to have a lot of power speaking to CEOs and CFOs about proper business practices. I had power arguing cases in front of the commission. I'm a USC law school grad as well, and it's very hard giving up all that prestige to be a stay-at-home mom and being able to say, well, I don't do anything when people say, what do you do? And I think that when you achieve something, as the women on the panel have, that becomes a very important part of your self-identity, whether you call it, power or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to recognize that that is part of who you are at this point in time and what your self-image is.
So go ahead,
really
Patty.
It's a really good point. I mean, if these women didn't have it, would they strive for it? Maybe. But you know, it intrigues me that you are saying this. You're saying you miss it, but you left your big job and you had other priorities. And that's the very point of the story, is that, you know, these women so many of these women believe that there will be parity in terms of gender representation at the top of the various spheres, corporate America, government, academia someday, even though the same women saying this are women, now I don't know if you believe that, but are women like you who say, you know, hey, it's important to me, but other things are really important to me too, like my family, so I'm leaving the big job.
Well, that's exactly right, and it was a very tough decision to make. And what I found especially frustrating was, at least in the government context, I could not do and would not be allowed to do my very high-level job on a part-time or four-fifths-time basis. There simply was no room for that, so I chose family.
Mm-hmm. See, I think you define power broadly. I mean, power to you. I mean, I don't want to put the words in your mouth, but from what you're saying, it seems to me that you define power sort of horizontally, as I said. It's about, you know, it's about the job, but it's also about family. It's about your kids.
Myrtle Potter, you have two kids. You mentioned them earlier in the program. The choice that Kate made that was obviously so difficult for her, was that something that you contemplated at any point?
Yeah, well, I definitely think there probably isn't a working mother out there that hasn't thought about whether or not she was striking the right balance between her job and her kids. And I certainly thought about staying home with my children. My mother was a working mother, even though she had six children. So I had a wonderful role model as I watched her growing up, regarding how to balance it all and get it all done. And at the end of the day, I really believed that the benefits I could bring to my kids by having myself as an example for them for what they could accomplish and how they could work and do both. I thought that was important. I enjoyed my career very, very much, got a lot of satisfaction from it, but at the same time, of course, loved being a mother. So over the years, and I continue to work really hard to balance and keep it all going, but for me, at the end of the day, I made the choice, number one, to have children. Having children was very important to me. But number two, I also made the choice to continue to work. What does that mean? That means I have late nights. There are times I'm sewing ballet costumes at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. There are times I'm making midnight runs to the grocery store. But those are the choices I've made, and I love my life.
And Sue
I love
Desmond,
having my kids.
Sue Desmond-Hellman, you, as we mentioned earlier in the program, came from a very large family, and your decision not to have children, to pursue your medical career, was keyed in part by that and your notion of what you could do both as a parent and as a doctor, right?
That's right. And I think it is in part that my role models were my father, who worked and supported the family, and my mom, who stayed at home. And I loved having my mom at home. And for me, that's what a mom did, because my mom did that and I counted on it. I think it is a tough juggling act for everyone. For me, it was something where I decided not to have kids, and my husband and I are very happy with that decision. It also allowed us to do some things that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. We spent a couple of years in East Africa as visiting faculty studying AIDS and cancer, and had a number of experiences like that where the two of us, and he's a physician as well, could literally just pick up and move. So a very different set of choices, and I really respect your caller, because I think that's the kind of juggling that Patty captured in the story that all of us have.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about power and the way that it is viewed by women. This hour, we have two very high-profile women in American business talking about the way that they see it and the way it has affected their lives. We'd like to hear about you and the way that you see the definition or the grasp of power, and whether or not it's somehow different in the eyes of women than men. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. We're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, differing definitions of power. The male side would say that it might show up as a golf handicap or a salary or a size of the home in the Hamptons. Certainly, which spot that person occupies on the corporate ladder, whereas the women executives might be more inclined to talk about how they can make a difference and whether or not what they do actually matters. And so we're trying to figure out if we can put our finger on how those two different definitions work in understanding the way society sees power today. Let's take our next call from Creedmoor, North Carolina. Neil's with us now. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I was listening to your discussion, and, you know, I'm not bashing women or the female gender or anything like that, but these are my feelings. Now, I don't want to just put this all on Martha Stewart, but I feel that generally when women get in power, I look at Oprah on TV and all these famous women that do have power.
Right.
And Martha Stewart took a... You know, she abused her power really bad. She took advantage of the fact that she could get insider information. She took her money out of M-Clone, and she left a lot of people high and dry. You know, that's not fair. And
a lot of men executives at about the same time were doing the same thing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree there. Anybody, but this is my feeling, anybody, whether it be a man or a woman,
right,
should be held accountable exactly the same. You know, there's no equality until the justice is the same for everyone. You know, Martha Stewart's saying she don't think she's going to go to jail, because of what she does. I hope she does. I hope she goes to jail for a very long time.
Neil, let me just bring you back to the point that we're talking about, this question of power. Are you saying that there is not a difference in your mind between the way that men and women see power?
Oh, absolutely. There is a difference in the way men and women see power. I'm a truck driver I drive a truck for a living, and power to me is more of a physical. Women are more verbal. They talk a lot of things out, and they talk more civilly than men do. And I think that is the difference between the male and the female mind. Men often use vulgar languages and, you know, physical means to get their job, to get their point across, whereas women are more just verbally. They, you know, women treat other women, give them the silent treatment, you know, or cut them out of this or cut them out of that. And whereas men will tell each other right straight to their face, you know, get out of my face before, or I'm, you know, something's going to happen. And women,
I know a few women who do that. I know a few women who do that.
Yeah, right. But, you know, the power thing, everybody wants to feel like they're in power, in control of whatever part of their life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are differences, and we all need to recognize that there are differences between men and women. And even though there are differences, that
let me take what you're saying, if I can, Neil, and put it to let's have Sue answer this one. If we put this in terms of kind of, what's the word, naked ambition, a man sort of saying, you know, I'm going to put my truck in third gear and go straight up that hill because that to me is an expression of power. Get out of my way. Is that really something that is unique to the male character when you look at it from a business point of view?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think from a business point of view, in my job at Genentech, we have a very diverse employee population, and I can tell you that it's much more style and personality of that individual rather than whether they're a male or a female. Mm-hmm. As I said before, we're really passionate about what we're doing, and it's not uncommon that there'll be a gal who's raising her voice and standing up and thumping her fist on the table because she cares passionately about her point of view on some aspect of drug development. And alternatively, there may be a guy who does the same thing. But I think in the corporate world, what we see is people bring their own styles and their capabilities. And my personal point of view is those styles and capabilities are not sex-linked. They're really much more personality and how you were brought up and really your own way of operating.
Now, Myrtle, I read a quote from a writer named of Noel Tichy, I think. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. But he said about you that you're the type of executive who pushes people out of their comfort zone, that you're actually not an easy person for someone to work with unless that person wants to be pushed. And I'm wondering, just thinking of what Neil was saying, whether or not that's a different way of expressing a certain amount of aggressiveness at the workplace. You may be more demanding in that way.
I certainly think that I have very high expectations of the company that I'm with right now and high expectations of the people who are on my team. And as we mentioned earlier, we work every day to make a difference in saving people's lives. And so one of my responsibilities, one of Sue's responsibilities, is to always ask the question, can we be doing it better? Can we be doing something differently? So at the end of the day, we continue to make a difference in terms of the drugs that we're developing, the speed at which they're coming to market, and the benefit that they're providing to patients in need. So I think, Noel, I remember the quote, and I think he's probably right. I do push people out of their comfort zones in an effort to help the organization grow, help them grow, and help me grow as a leader. But that also means that along with that comes making a difference for patients. And at the same time, having a lot of fun, enjoying our culture, enjoying our work environment, and at the end of the day, as a team, feeling like we've really made a difference.
Let's take another call.
You know what?
Dick, Patty, let me just go
sure.
to we've got a number of people who are trying to get in, and I'm not going to get to them all. Let's,
sure.
Let's go
absolutely.
To Salem, Massachusetts. Adam's on the line now. Adam, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just had a quick question. Of these people, of these women that are on the list,
yeah.
Of the ones that are married, what are the roles of the husbands in the family?
Patty, have you got statistics there for us?
I do. About a third of them have husbands who stay at home. We actually did the cover story last year was a story on trophy husbands. We had noticed this really interesting phenomenon, and we've surveyed women at our annual Most Powerful Women Summit, and we've surveyed the women on the list, and pretty much a third of the group in each case. And we did a really interesting story last year about this phenomenon. And, you know, it's not easy to make it work. But the women who can make it work actually have a really good deal. They have corporate spouses just like the guys have wonderful corporate wives.
What's a trophy husband? I think I know what a trophy wife is, but what's a trophy husband?
A trophy husband, as illustrated on our cover a year ago, was this guy was actually the husband of the general counsel at The Gap, and he was on the cover in an apron with his two adorable little daughters hanging on his apron strings. They you know, pick up the kids from school, and they do a lot of the, the bill paying, and the, you know, they might be renovating the house, they might be doing shopping, and there are a lot of them out there, and they used to be kind of in the closet, but it's become in court the high levels of corporate America, it's become a much more acceptable thing.
Myrtle, Sue, do you guys have trophy husbands?
No, I don't.
This is Sue. I have a husband who has a job that's also very busy and hectic, and we have a consistent juggling act between the two of us. So he's definitely not a trophy husband.
He does the house, you do the cooking. You kind of got it divided up, right?
We've got it divided up. We have a schedule. We know who's coming and going. That's actually our biggest challenge, is to figure out if someone's at home to pick up the paper outside and whether the milk will be spoiled. But we have a great system that we've had for more than 20 years now, where we share all the chores in the house, and we're really interested in what each other are doing. And I would say he's my chief cheerleader, and I'm his chief cheerleader.
And Myrtle, you had four your kids when they were smaller live-in help for most of the time during that period. Is that right?
I had young girls staying in my home when my kids were little,
right,
just to help balance all the work, because at the time my husband was working, I was working. He is an attorney. He's now general counsel at Del Monte Foods. And though we're no longer together, when we were together, we definitely had some help with the kids.
I'm interested in hearing from both of you about one of the other features that's come up in the reporting about women executives and power, and that is the young women surveyed, who look at what you have put yourselves through, both of you, and saying to the interviewer, you know what? I don't want that, because you, Myrtle and Sue, you work too hard. You're strung out. I don't want a career that is so demanding. And I guess I'm curious to know if you see in any way an expression of that from the young people that you know, either at your workplace or elsewhere, that they look at you and they think, oh, boy, I don't want to make that kind of commitment.
Yeah, this is Myrtle. I would say that we see a diversity of desires and aspirations in young men and women in our company. The wonderful thing about Genentech is that we have multiple tracks that people can take in managing their career. If someone has the aspiration to be the COO like I am, or be the chief medical officer like Sue is, there's a path within the organization that will get them there. On the other hand, if someone decides that they really don't want to pursue management opportunities and they'd prefer to be an individual contributor, there are means for them to excel and grow and get increasing levels of responsibility and pay as an individual contributor.
But I would suspect that has something to do with the fact that there are women executives at the firm who can say, well, that's the way I was, or I respect that, because in a completely male hierarchy, someone who says, I'm just going to stay where I am, I don't really want to keep on climbing at a managerial level, so like raise an eyebrow, Sue, and say, well, why do you want to stop there?
Well, I do think that having executives who are female at Genentech does make a big difference. And I know Myrtle hears and I hear from folks in our groups that they can see someone who they could become if they do aspire to that. Very unlike the experience I had when I was in academic medicine, for example, where I had very, very few role models who were female. So I think that there is a positive aspect of having female executives. But I agree with Myrtle. I think what's great about Genentech right now as a growing company with lots of opportunities is not all the opportunities look alike. And employees are really encouraged, and we have active mentorship and leadership development. They're encouraged to look at where they can contribute.
Okay.
And that may be as an executive, maybe as a scientist, or a lot of other roles at the company.
Brass tacks, though. Let's say that a couple of minutes from now, when you get up from your seats in the studios of KQED and walk outside, someone says, you know, Arthur Levinson, the head of Genentech, has just quit, and they're looking for someone to be the boss. What would you say? Sue, Myrtle, would you say, oh, yeah, I'd like that job, or would you say no?
You know, I think we'd probably say that we would rely on the board to make the decision that's best for the company. Bottom line.
What would you then be thinking about?
Number one goal is, I think Sue and I would both do whatever the organization asks us to do. And that goes in this situation or any other situation. We would do what the company wants us to do to better the performance of the company for our shareholders, for our employees, and for our patients.
Yeah, I agree with Myrtle. I think, you know, first of all, I would say that Art's a fantastic leader and a great role model for both Myrtle and I. So I hope he decides to stay in the job a very long time. Let's say that. But I feel no different than Myrtle. We'd look to the board, and if either of us were called on to do more for the company, I'm sure we would agree to it. For us, it's just that the driving force is what we're accomplishing as a company, and that's the special thing.
And why do I think that if I asked that question 20 years ago to a male, he'd have said, yeah, I'll take the job. Sue Desmond-Hellmann, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Sue is Chief Medical Officer at the firm Genentech. And Myrtle Potter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Myrtle is Chief Operating Officer at the same company. Patty Sellers is Editor-at-Large with Fortune Magazine, and it was her work that put us onto this story. Patty, thanks for your help.
Thank you, Dick.
And we also heard on this program from California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. She is the House Democratic leader. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.